Welcome to another episode of How to Exit. My name is Dennis Majoriski, and I am an M&A advisor. I help clients buy, sell, and value businesses. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about life insurance, and not personal life insurance. We're going to be talking about how do you do business succession planning using life insurance products. For that, I invited my good friend Mark Salvaggi. Did I just butcher your name?
No, you did perfect.
Excellent. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Mark Salvaggi.
That's a very short introduction.
That's all I got.
Mark Salvaggi is a life insurance agent with New York's Life. He's got really interesting business background that I want him to talk about and expand.
Sure.
So please expand a little bit.
All right, I'll go a little bit further. Please. Sorry about that, Dennis. So I started a company right out of college, my first soiree into business. I started a small specialty retail company called Plaster Funtime.
Yep.
It's a drop-in painting place where kids come in and paint plaster figurines.
Yep.
Started with one store in Reading in November of 95, added a store every couple of years for approximately 20 years. I grew it to 10 locations. We had a store in Reading, Natick, Newton, Salem, Dedham, Braintree, Chelmsford, Charlestown, Saugus, and Somerville, Massachusetts. And we operated that company for 20 years. So I started it from zero, grew it to 10 locations. We had about 65 employees,
yep.
$3.5 million a year in sales. And I successfully sold the company in April of 2015. From there, I wanted to move into the insurance business. I personally didn't own any life insurance. I didn't have any key person insurance. I didn't have a buy-sell agreement. I didn't have any succession plan or any exit strategy in mind.
Did that hurt you in the end?
Of course it did. I really feel like most small business owners don't have an end game when they start. I think most people go in potentially with a partner to help ease the pain or some equity investors. And they go in with a business plan. I think most of the people that I talk to have a plan and they have an idea of how to get into the business. I'd say I haven't met the person that started a business with a proper exit strategy. And I think if I had to rewind the clocks of time and go back 20 years, I would have started with the end in mind and worked towards that.
Yep.
I would have met with a business broker and said, what are the levers and what are the things that they're going to measure the sale of my business on, rather than just saying, someday or some amount or whatever. I think the biggest misconception I think a lot of people go at is, well, eventually the business will take off, run itself, and I'll be able to step aside. I find that to be not the case. Most businesses do require a lot of handholding. Very few of them can be run on autopilot, the ones that I've seen that are successful. So I think by going with a clear exit strategy, how much money do you want in the bank? How much do you want the business to be worth? What do you want your health to be? What do you want to get out? I also learned a bunch of things along the sale process that I didn't know. You can't sell a business that's in decline. You can't sell a business that has static growth. You can't sell businesses that nobody wants to buy. And to be honest, most people don't want to part with them while they're doing well and while they're going through their heydays. They want to just kind of pat themselves on the back and ride the wave. And then as soon as it starts to plateau or decline, they say, well, maybe I should get out. And then it's too late.
Yeah. So what's the target size of the business that can utilize? Well, we'll get into what life insurance vehicles you're able to use in order to plan the business succession. But what's the size of the business? I mean, it has to be big enough.
Right. I'd say it's bigger than a solo prop, right? And it's smaller than a multi-state, multinational company.
Yeah.
So the sweet spot I find are people that were just like me. So what do I mean by that, Dennis? I mean 1 million to 10 million size businesses, revenue, under 100 employees, a couple of key people, maybe some sort of partnership, maybe some sort of stock that's been issued to multiple people where you have different interest levels, different commitment levels, different skill sets. Those are the people that are ideal for me to work with, outline the risks that are exposed, that they're exposed to, that they're unbeknownst to.
Yeah. So I want to concentrate on a couple things. I'm going to use examples that with the whole business transaction process, and I see issues happening that prevents the sale. So this is going to be all geared towards the exit. Specifically, in a partnership, I feel like the partnership is the biggest risk factors. When there are multiple partners in one single business, what are the types of vehicles you are able to help a business owner create in a business succession if there's multiple partners, they have multiple families, they have multiple ways of thinking, they have multiple exit plans.
Sure.
How do you combine this all into one
sure.
in terms of insurance products
Great.
And vehicles?
Well, the first part is I firmly believe that a partnership is a sinking ship in many ways. I know that 52% of marriages end in divorce and 100% of partnerships end. Nobody realizes that, and they don't go at it with a clear strategy on how to get out of it and how to extricate yourself from it.
Yep.
Dennis, if you and I are partners into anything,
who's,
and we each own 50%, that's a dangerous...
There has to be a majority.
I have to be at least
51.
Right, but most people don't do that, right?
Yeah.
They go at it, and they're really optimistic on day one and the first day of a partnership.
Yeah.
And we'll split everything 50-50. We'll do the work 50-50. And when you want to take off time, I'll fill in for you, blah, blah, blah. So I think the first mistake people make is the 50-50 partnership. Dennis, the reason you know right away to say 51% is because you've helped people through out of these messes, and you realize that 50% is probably the most dangerous amount of a company.
So
that you
what can they do? We have a business, three partners, multiple partners,
whatever
multiple
it is,
ages.
However many partners there are and whatever ages there are, what you have to do first of all is disturb everybody and make them realize that they do have a succession plan that's built for them. It might not be the one that they want or the one that they even know that exists. But if you and I are partners, or you, me, and a few other people are partners, if I pass away, I get hit by a bus on my lunch hour, you're now in business with my wife. She owns all of those shares of that company or that partnership automatically. Doesn't go through probate. She automatically owns it. She may know nothing about our business. She may not have the same skill set that I have, but she's now your equal equity partner. On day one, she's going to want two things: to be bought out, and she's going to want a paycheck. What are the two things that company can no longer do the day it just lost one of its key people or its partner?
Yeah.
It has the inability to borrow money, and it's also worth a heck of a lot less.
So what's the solution for that situation?
The first thing is you have to agree on a methodology for evaluating the business. First of all, you have to know how much it's worth. If you and I are partners and you come in and tell me that you're dying of pancreatic cancer and you have less than a year to live, first day I'm sad. Second day, you think the business is worth 2x and I think it's worth half x. Now we're an x and a half apart. So what do we have to do? The first thing we have to do is, before there's trouble in the water, before the first bloodshed occurs and the first fight occurs, we have to come up with a logical methodology for evaluating a business. I would probably contact you. I'd say, Dennis, we have a business here. How would businesses like this get valued? What are the metrics that you'd use to measure it by? What's their EBITDA? What's their industry multiple? All these types of questions, I would probably pass that off to you. Now we have a valuation method. Now we have a value, and we have a way to value it at some date in the future. Business might be wildly successful and we may not get together again for 5 years. We have to have it
so
it works.
How often do you meet with a client?
I prefer once a year at the very minimum, or if any life events occur, marriage, birth of a child, new partnership, new equity play, new business acquisition, any sort of life event that occurs in that business's life cycle, I want to be brought into that equation. Now we have a methodology for evaluating. What do we have? What is it worth? Rather than trying to negotiate that under duress, terrible situation, and it doesn't work. Second thing is, where's the funding mechanism? Where's the money coming from? If a business is in trouble, or if it's losing an equity partner, or it's losing a talent or an asset of the company, it's less valuable. How much less valuable? Well, we've already figured that out. So now we have to have money to fill that vacuum. Where's the money come from? The cheapest place to do it is always life insurance. Life insurance, if it's structured properly, is always going to give you more value than you put into it. It's leverage. That's why the wealthiest people in the world and the wealthiest companies in the world, Bank of America is our biggest client. Oprah Winfrey, one of the wealthiest women in America, she owns the most life insurance. Why do they own life insurance? It's leverage. And it's leverage that's uniquely timed to fill the vacuum when something critical happens, usually a passing of a partner.
So you come in, you do a valuation of the company, you figure out what the value of the company is. Individual shareholders of the partners will figure out what their individual shares are.
Correct.
Who pays for the life insurance?
The company owns the life insurance policy. And what we would do is the company would pay the premiums on the policy.
Mm-hmm.
The company then would do what's called a split dollar arrangement, where they would have money go to the company on that partner's passing, and then they would have money that would go to the new shareholder to redeem the shares from the widow.
So the life insurance will buy out
Correct. The partner.
The partner.
Correct.
Giving the money to the...
to the person that's now separating from the company. There's a stock redemption plan to where they would retrieve those stocks depending on the organization of the company and how it's structured legally. But what it would do is it would buy the shares from that person so that they are no longer your business partner. They would effectively buy them out. The valuation, the methodology, everything else is already established. They get what they need. The company also gets money. Anytime a company loses an asset like that, whether it's through premature death or other means, there's always a bump in the road. There's going to be a hiccup on their balance sheet mm-hmm. that they're going to need money to overcome that obstacle. Most companies are cash starved when they have an event like that. So the life insurance is dually purposed in that it makes the party that's exiting the business whole, and then it makes the company whole also so that it can weather the bounce that's coming with the loss of the talent that it just lost.
How many partners? So what if there's more than 5, 4, 7? Does it matter?
It doesn't matter at all. And there's a number of ways to structure
investors. Can it work with investors?
It can.
Silent partners?
Absolutely. And you can have it, and you can have it all different ways. Like if you didn't, the money from a life insurance policy is only tax-free on the first time. So if I pay $1 million to your company and $1 million to your partner's wife to redeem the shares, it's tax-free on the first pass. If the company then uses that money and parses it out to all of its partners, now it becomes taxable. Mm-hmm. So there's other strategies that we can use. Those are called cross-purchase, where each partner could own a life insurance policy on the other partners. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of paperwork. But there's basically three different strategies.
So three partners.
Right.
You we
would each, exactly right. We would each own one on you rather than paying the company and then the company having this cash. And how does it distribute it still on a tax-free basis? That's kind of the question. So there's other ways where you can have it where it just pays all the other partners. That's more common in a law firm mm-hmm. to where there's really no there. The company doesn't really retain any earnings. It doesn't own any products. It's really just a profit sharing arrangement between all the partners. So in those situations, we do cross purchases where each partner owns a policy mm-hmm. on the other partner, and people come and go quite often in law firms, much more tidy.
How expensive does it get? I know this is a very generic question, but.
So there's all different types of life insurance, and life insurance, unlike other types of insurance, it's not always the cheapest way isn't always the best way. So sometimes with life insurance policies, there's term insurance. That's probably the most popular, the most common, the one that most people know about. And that just what the term really means is it covers you for a predetermined amount of time. A year, 10 years, 5, 20, they even came out with a 40-year product. That's term insurance. Mathematically, it's designed not to work, and it's really for the just in case. If something happens mathematically, you get hit by lightning, you get struck by... The what if. The one in a term insurance mathematically pays out, depending on your age, I'm 46, it'll pay out roughly 4.6% of the time on a 20-year term.
What's the probability?
Right. So it's got a 95.5% failure ratio, right? So that's not great. Then there's other types of products that have emerged. Whole life has been around just as mm-hmm. long as term insurance has. And that's one that covers you for your whole life. That's one that takes a much larger financial commitment. It's typically 10 times more expensive than term insurance. The difference with whole life is mathematically it pays out 100% of the time. It also... with most of the products that I work with, it recaptures all the money that you put into it, recapitalizes it. You have access to all of the money, and it works really well for buyout strategies. Oftentimes when there's a disagreement, not sort of a premature death, but if there's a disagreement among partners, there's usually a lack of funding mm-hmm. available.
What about retirement?
People use it for retirement, and they also use it for taking out a partner. So the odds that you're going to go into a business with a series of partners, you're all going to retire at the exact same age, you're all going to be one out at the exact same moment, and all of your health is going to remain constant for the duration of the lifespan of the business.
Yeah,
that just doesn't happen. Right? You know that doesn't happen. So what cash value life insurance allows you to do is to have a pool of money that has no penalties, no taxes, anything else. It's just a pool of money that the policy is generating in a surplus account.
Yep.
We call it a cash surrender value, and that's available to you in a day. So if Dennis and I were partners and we have a disagreement, I say, Dennis, I can't work with you, and you say, Mark, I can't work with you. We both turn our backs on the business, and we both own 50% of the business. We can't do anything. I can't get rid of you, and you can't get rid of me, and the business ends up suffering and falling flat. If you had a cash value life insurance policy, I could say, Dennis, I got $80,000 in my cash value life insurance contract.
But you need to build cash in that.
You do. It takes time.
How long does it? What's in terms of business succession planning, Everybody's in the in the different stages.
Right.
Most people are in the stages like, oh my God,
right.
I need to sell in the next year.
Right. So in short duration stuff like that, where I need to sell in the next year, or I need to take out my partner in the next year. Yeah. Life insurance isn't going to gain you enough leverage quickly enough. It's more of a long term play. It's a, I would only use cash value life insurance policies for a 10-year exit strategy, 10-year plus. That's a great analogy. There's products that are designed to be paid for 10 years, and then they just continue to grow and they're paid off. They're also transferable. So if you leave in 10 years and you get your equity in the business, you could take your life insurance policy with you, and it could be paid up and owned by you. And the cash value inside that is tax-free. So you could take that out at any time.
But the company's paying for it.
The company's paying for it, and then that would be part of your buyout package. They could transfer the equity in that policy and the transfer the insurability of you with the exit of the business and your succession plan. So if we have all varying ages and people want to slide down the dinosaur at different parts of their life, they can take the policy with them. It's transferable and assumable. The opposite is true. If you leave and you don't want the policy and you're loaded now, the company can retain it, and it's also assumable. So the next person they hire to take your place, they could step into that exact same policy and they would continue where it left off. So they would be assumable and they can just continue it on. And so some companies will use that for key person insurance. Think like chefs or people that are unique to their own industry and are indispensable and irreplaceable will oftentimes use key insurance on those people and then have it where they own it at a predetermined amount of time.
So we're talking perfect world scenario, 10 plus years of succession planning.
Correct.
In the 10 plus years, every year in business life, what's today and what's in the next 2 years is going to be a completely different story.
Correct.
How often should a business owner be looking at the buy-sell agreements, at the insurance policies? I mean, is it really necessary to update it? I don't think anybody updating it every 12 months. Nobody does.
What they should do is they should, especially if they're dealing with a cash value policy where it's accumulating cash and you have moving pieces and the value of the business is changing, they absolutely should have a cash value policy if they have a 10-year window or greater. Less than that, it probably should be a term vessel and use a different type of savings vehicle for their exit strategy. But in answer to your question, every single year, if the company is really very consistent and it's been in business for a long time, that's great. If it's a new business and it's got a very steep growth curve, then it absolutely has to be every single year. But just talking about this brings me to one part that I deal with a lot of family businesses. Mm-hmm. And my business was no different. But what we talk about oftentimes is called an equalization strategy. So one that comes to mind is a funeral parlor that I worked with recently. They had three children, and the father was a mortician, and the brother and sister both went to mortician school, and they were going to take over the business. Mm-hmm. It was valued at roughly $1.5 million with the real estate and everything else. They have another sister who lives on the West Coast who wants nothing to do with the mortuary business. All parents love all their children the same. So there was an equalization strategy that we employed. So this scenario was different. We put term insurance on both the people who were taking over the mortuary business. And then we did a cash value whole life insurance policy that the daughter on the West Coast was going to be the beneficiary of. And what that allows the parent to do is augment to make sure
everybody gets equal, but
equal
then
because
the two
everybody
are running,
gets so out of it what they wanted, and they can always end up changing all the levers and the bells at the end. So the life insurance allows you to dial up or down the face amount or augment the cash value to make sure that all siblings or the next generation, they all come out equal, especially with a succession plan. So we call it an equalization strategy. We use it. People aren't aware of it, and they think, well, she'll get the house, and the other two will get the business. The odds that all that's coming out and shaking out at the exact you value businesses for a living, they change quarterly. The odds that you're going to be able to see 10 years in the future and be able to map dot that one, no way. Yeah. So you have to have tools at your disposal that you can just turn up and down the volume on that allow you to make sure that everyone in your family gets what they want out of the deal and that business doesn't end up being divisive, because death and taxes do crazy things to people, and people can end up fighting over really trivial things. So it does give people a lot of bandwidth, and they really, really like it for those purposes.
That sounds like a good idea. I didn't know about the combinations. So you own a successful business.
Yes.
You exited through a successful business.
Yes.
You had no life insurance policies.
Correct.
What are the life and thankfully nobody died.
Right.
You successfully exited.
Correct.
You sold the business.
Right.
What are the insurance policies that you should have had in place?
Correct.
That you didn't.
So the first
and
thing
why?
Was, this is a great question, Dennis, so thank you. The first thing is, I find every small business owner wants to invest in themselves, and I think that's great. What they don't realize is they have a wealth concentration problem, and I had a wealth concentration problem. 90% of my wealth was my business.
Yes.
My business wouldn't even be a penny stock. Why? It's not a $100 million company. It is so vulnerable to so many different things. I worked in the children entertainment space. And if anything ever went wrong, if a child got hurt, if a child went missing, if anything ever happened, God forbid, that business would be worthless. 20 years of blood, sweat, and tears would be down the tubes. So what most people don't realize is when they own a business, they now have a wealth concentration problem. And they're going to invest in themselves and invest in themselves and invest in themselves. But I also flip it around on clients and I say, what if you bought a penny stock today? What if you liquidated everything you owned and put it all on a penny stock? Does anybody think that's a good idea? Does anybody at all think, everybody laughs at that one. And I always tell people, your business is 100 times more vulnerable than that penny stock. You have all of your assets in that, and you have your job, and you have your savings, and sometimes it's a family business. You have the entire family in the same basket of risk. That's incredibly risky. So I always say to myself, I wish I met me 20 years prior. Why? I would have put a cash value life insurance policy on myself. I would have paid $1,000 a month into that. That policy would have been an enormous policy by the end of 20 years. It'd be over $1 million. That is something I wish I had done. What was the precipitous? How did I know I was grossly undercovered? It was a close call. It was a fatal car accident right here on Route 3, right where we are right today. And I was involved in it. The person right in front of me had a medical event behind the wheel, crashed in the back of an 18-wheeler, and it looked just like a NASCAR crash, like smoke everywhere. I drove through it. The person in front of me passed away. I did CPR on them. And I was like, holy cow, what if I left 4 seconds earlier today?
Yeah.
The outcome could have been vastly different. Also, how sellable is my business if I'm not there to sell it? I'm the CEO, I'm everything. I also signed the paychecks. I have 65 people that aren't going to get paid on Friday. I have all these variables and all the intellectual property that I've acquired over 20 years of running a business are all in my head. If I perish that day, now my wife runs the business. She hasn't a clue to where to begin. She's an intelligent woman, but would she ever be able to do everything that I did every day without any bumps in the road? No way. And then also all my wealth is in the sale of that business someday.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to buy a business that just lost its founder and everything? Who's going to buy that business? Nobody. They're going to try to rent it. They're going to see if maybe they can make a go of it, but no one's going to.
No. Now you have the vendors. They're calling, we want to make sure our bills are going to get paid, like we heard.
Yeah, you can't even imagine.
So the whole company,
the whole 20 years of investing, reinvesting in yourself is great. You can just keep doubling down. But eventually, you know, everything has to go perfectly well. You can't sell it during a decline. You can't sell it during a bad economic time. You can't sell it when lending standards are down. You can't sell. So there's a very small window that nobody really realizes that how small that window really is. You have to have positive growth. You have to have at least 2 years of positive growth and to make it ideal. And those key people, they have to be able to be replaced. So sometimes people work themselves into a perfect job to where they can never leave. And I find lots of people do that. So what I try to do is say, if you couldn't walk through that door tomorrow, and only thing you could do was slide a check under the door to guarantee the welfare of that business or to guarantee the welfare of that family that's involved in that business, how big is the check? What does it look like? And why don't we have that available to them today? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are like, oh, if I couldn't walk through that door exactly. You can't walk through the door tomorrow. All you can do is slide checks under the door. What does the check look like? And then they kind of have a realization and they say, wow, that business that I ended up selling, now it's worthless without you. So I was, you know, a nanosecond away from that happening. It didn't happen. But at that moment, I was like, wow, I have some terrible advisors in my life that didn't force me to do that. My accountant, I found to be, they should have alerted me to the weaknesses in my planning. But really, with small business owners, who's responsible for coaching you on all aspects of it?
You're kind of on your own.
Right. You're kind of on your own. And you have to be like born with this
knowledge. Plus, I think you also use strap for cash. You worry about the payroll, meeting the payroll every week.
Yeah.
Not worried about putting money in the life insurance.
No, and you think that you're going to sell this business someday. And I think most people have a gross overestimate of what their business is actually worth. I mean, sometimes by a ridiculous margin.
The most estimation is based on how much money a business owner needs for retirement. It has nothing to do with the valuation of the business in most of the cases. Like, this is what I need to live on. I mean, this is,
how is that relevant? I would say, like, I need to get this. Like, it's worth what someone will pay for it, right? So I agree with you, Dennis, but I find that the more diversified their assets are, the better they can weather every storm that's coming, yeah. And it's not if but when they arrive.
So that's great. I appreciate you sharing, Mark. I want to talk about key employee, key personal insurance vehicles.
Sure.
We have right now currently, I think, 4 or 5 different consultings that we're doing for general manager or family owner, family buying out the business owner. Talk about the key employee insurance and different ways a business owner can use key employee policies, costs around them, and just overall just define what that might
be. Sure. So I use key person insurance as a retention tool. So I ran a business. I used to stay up at night worrying about certain key people. And I used to say to myself, if they walk in tomorrow and give their 2 weeks notice, I'm screwed. If they walk in tomorrow and say, I need to make double, I actually have to pay them that because I can't operate my business without them. That fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Did you have somebody like that when you
were running? I did. I absolutely did.
Sure you did.
So I call it FUD, right? Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. That is the stuff that stiff necks and stress that you can see in every small business owner across the country. They all have it. They know where the weaknesses are in that business, and they know if they're people. And nothing is harder than controlling something that's outside of your control, which is their life. So I moved to New York Life and found a vehicle, and I said, man, I wish I knew this existed. So it's a Section 162 executive bonus. What is it? It's a key person life insurance policy on the key person. Who uses it? Restaurant chefs, people with indispensable talents, and the company is going to have a serious issue on their hands if that person leaves. It's basically a talent that isn't easily reproducible. So let's just take a restaurant and they have a chef and the restaurant's doing well, the chef's doing well, everybody's happy, but in the back of the owner of the restaurant's mind, they have a little bit of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Then they say, what if I could show you a vehicle that A, you're going to insure them because they leave here late at night. Sometimes chefs have extracurricular habits and they lead riskier lifestyles than your average 9-to-5er. Let's say you're worried about that. Let's say you're worried about them having a disability. And let's say you're worried about them leaving you someday to go to work for another restaurant for a larger opportunity. What we do is a Section 162 executive bonus key person life insurance policy on them. It's a cash value accumulating policy. It usually has a 10-year or however long, the business owner generally wants to retain that employee for. 10 years is a long time in a restaurant business. Mm-hmm. That's like a career in any other business. But 10 years is the ones that seems to be resonate with the most people. And they said, if I can get 10 years out of this person, this is great. How does it work? Typically, it's going to be, say it's $250,000 whole life insurance policy that's paid up in 10 years. What they would do is they would contribute $10,000 a year in premiums to this policy. They let the insured, the key person, get statements. They can see the cash value growing.
They can't touch it.
They can't touch it. But they can see it and their name is on there because they're the insured. Now, if they pass away, the restaurant gets $250,000 to help them weather the bounce that they're going to need to go out and hire, train, and retain a new chef and to deal with the loss in sales. Secondly, if that chef gets disabled, terrible skiing accident, breaks his arm, less productive. The policy would pay for itself because it has a disability policy built into the life insurance policy called a waiver premium. Third thing is, you have to have a carrot big enough to keep them through the dark moments. What dark moments? If you've ever worked in a restaurant, they happen every single night. But the reality is it's a high stress job and there's certain differences of opinions and there's a lot of attrition in that business. So what happens is stress levels tend to boil up. And you need something to keep them through those stressful events and to help them get to a clearer state of mind down the road when things seem to calm down and not leave in a huff. So what we would do is we would initiate a key person life insurance policy on that person. And then the Section 162 executive bonus is basically a contract that says at the end of 10 years, the company will change ownership of this policy from the company to the employee.
At the end of the 10 years.
At the end of the 10 years. Provided they're in good standing with the company, they get own the policy. The policy at the end of 10 years has all the value of all the cash that the company contributed to it available and in cash surrender value. So basically, they're going to contribute $10,000 a year to this contract. At the end of 10 years, there's $100,000 in cash. The key person employee is seeing the statements. They're seeing the cash value build in this. And that statement alone tends to help people think through those heated moments, those heated debates, those heated weekends, those whatever happens, that tends to increase their loyalty to the company. And it also starts to act as golden handcuffs. Now, reality, no chef makes it 10 years. At the end of the time when that chef ends up departing, 3 years, 4 years, very common, now the company owns that asset. That person has surrendered the value to that, to the company. They have no entitlements to that at all. Now that company can use that $40,000 in cash value in that policy as a signing bonus for the next chef that they go out and retain. And then they could say in 6 years, this policy is going to be worth $100,000 and it's all yours. All you have to do is work here 6 years to earn it. Or maybe they could extend the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, imagine a scenario where you could give somebody bonuses. And then if they were to leave, they'd have no ability to retain
those bonuses. Is this vehicle also used for helping a key employee accumulate a down payment for eventual purchase of the business? Is that exactly the same?
Of course it is. And also, if you've run a business, people come to you with the most bizarre requests. They want personal loans. They want advances. They want you to co-sign for God knows what. All true. What it allows the business owner to do is they have access to the cash value mm-hmm. in that policy. Contractually, all the money has to be there on the day that the anniversary date, whatever that date is, 10 years from now. But they have access to that cash value. If they have a cash crunch and they can't meet payroll on Friday and they need $10,000, they can take the cash value out of that policy and use it to meet payroll.
The employee policy?
The employer. The person that owns the policy, generally the business.
Yeah.
So the business would have access to that cash value. So if the employee needed the money to down payment on a house, and if the employer wanted to engage in that, they could activate the distribution of the cash within the policy. The employee on himself, he can't do that. He can't do it without the corporate approval.
Yeah. Are there any other tools for succession planning in the business, specifically a key employee 5-year window? It's usually not longer than five.
Right.
A lot of the times the business doesn't want to tell
right.
or even think about exit or even mentioning the word exit or business sale
sure.
in the conversation. So is there a shorter
yeah,
term
can do,
that we
you
can
do? Yeah, you can do any duration. The reason I like the 10-year ones is people seem to be able to see a decade into the future, and they also seem to be able to see a decade in the past. If you ask me what I did in my 20s, it's a little bit of a blur. And if you ask me what 65 looks like, I can't really see it. But if you ask me what 56 looks like, I can see that. And if you ask me what 36 mm-hmm. looks like, I can still see that. So I like decade increments, and I want to try to get the business owner as much leverage as possible. Can you do a 5-year plan? Absolutely. Is it going to be the only detriment with a 5-year plan is those 5-year cash value policies. Sometimes they don't have all of the cash value, 100% of it, back available to them
yep.
at the end of the fifth year because you're paying for the cost to insure that person. So sometimes they're still kind of a little underwater at a 5-year mark. 10-year works much better. I'd say 7 is probably the smallest where you get all the money back out of the policy that you put into it. And at the end of the day, it's still life insurance also. It's not really a financial vehicle as much as it is protection. So it's really protection against premature death. It's protection against a disability for that person. And then it's protection against them leaving at an early juncture due to a sort of a quick quarrel or something like that.
Yeah. Any other insurance vehicles other than key personal insurance, Section 162 or 168, whatever?
162.
So there's
there's a lot of products, whether through buy, sell, key person, everything else.
Is this to be used for two different employees? So
Yeah.
To general managers.
Anything. Yeah. Catering director and the the person that books all the events, the event coordinator, and anytime you have somebody that you will lay awake at night and you worry, if they don't walk through that door again tomorrow, I'm in a lot of you know what. It could be anything in any business. It's also somebody that you really want to reward, but maybe they're not really good with money. And I'll be honest, I lost more employees by giving them raises than by not giving them raises. As soon as you give someone a raise, suddenly they feel like they were worth that right along, and you underpaid them for the last year. So I don't know what the bizarre psychology is behind that, but I found that bonuses also seem to, they don't seem to count that. So I would give people monthly bonuses based on their performance. Yeah. And they never really attributed it and did the money calculation to put it back into their hourly. So I had plenty of people I was paying, say, $15 an hour to, and then they'd get a bonus. And if you did the math backwards and added it back into their hourly, they're close to $20 an hour. And then they would leave me and go to work for somebody that was paying $18 an hour and say, I'm getting $3 more an hour. I said, actually, you're getting $2 less. What do you mean? Well, what about your bonuses? Well, that doesn't count. That's my bonus. I'm like, it's compensation. It's just how you're accounting for it. It's all the same. Like, so I always joke with people. I'm like, I'll give you $18 an hour, but I get to keep your bonus. Oh, that doesn't sound fair. So all these, really a lot of it is cup and ball games and it's perception. So what I find is giving people a bonus or giving them a raise, that's one way of compensating them. If I say to you, I'm taking out a key person life insurance policy on you, that's unique. If I say you're going to get ownership of this in 10 years, that's really unique, and it's going to have $100,000 in tax-free cash value in it at the end of 10 years. And do you think you would have been able to do that on your own? Probably not. Now it's a forced savings plan. So because of the multi-pronged approach, it's got a lot of teeth and it's got a lot of staying power, and I find it works way better than any sort of deferred comp plan that I've seen outlined. It just seems to have more teeth to it to me.
Refer any deferred compensation plans? Do you think any of them make sense for?
They do. They just have a lot of
for the succession planning piece.
For the succession plan, they do. They have their place. They're not inexpensive to originate. They're not inexpensive to maintain, and they're not without their own problems of stress testing them and administrating them. So the businesses I'm working with aren't over 100 employees. And when you get over 100 employees, you can get some really robust 401ks and defined benefit plans that are really quite good. But if you have less than that number of employees, the administrative costs on that sometimes wipes out all of the incremental benefit of having it in the first place. So I think the sort of under 100 employee or even under 50 employees and certainly under 25 employee, that arena, those vehicles, although they can do them, they're just not cost effective. So I don't utilize them on the real small business. I personally wouldn't have spent $5,000 a year to administer a 401k for my company of 65 employees. I know that was too big of a hurdle to cross. And also the money you're putting into that 401k, they don't consider it compensation. They don't add it back into their hourly. They don't add it back into their comp package when they're comparing your
company. They're actually deducting it, though.
Yeah.
This is how much money I got in
3%. And I always tell employers, like, I can give you a full short-term, long-term disability program that the company pays for less than 1% of payroll. If you add a 401k, that's going to cost you a minimum of 3% if that's what you choose to be a match, plus the administrative costs. So now you're around 5%. So I always ask people, what do you think your employee would perceive as a better benefit? A 401k with a 3% match or a full disability program that covers you for short-term and long-term disability?
Well,
and covers,
both. Usually.
Covers maternity. But the one costs 1% and the other one costs five times more. Yeah. I don't think it has five times the amount of benefit that the disability policy would have. So I always say it's perception is everything. And what people perceive is all that really matters. So I like to use different tactics than everybody else and use different tools than other people because it seems to differentiate yourself. In an environment where there's zero unemployment like we currently have, you need to use some clever resources and you have to differentiate yourself somehow. You don't want to be like, you're paying $17.50 an hour, I'm paying $18. Like if that's the level playing field, if you say I offer full benefits and I have, you know, whatever, the devil is in the details, and you have to make sure that you differentiate yourself from everyone else, and you have to make sure that they feel cared for. And life insurance, it's not, you know, as simple as darkening up some ovals on an open enrollment form.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into purchasing life insurance, a medical exam, a nurse visit. They pull all your medical record. It makes you feel like you're pretty important. So for those reasons, because of the gravity.
Well, it's kind of scary too, right? Yeah.
It is. I mean, maybe if you're afraid of needles, I don't know.
I mean, just the whole idea of life insurance is like it opens up a conversation about death, and nobody wants to talk
mortality,
about death.
Yeah,
well, like, what do you mean I'm not going to be around for 100 years? Like,
no, that's true. It does make people face their own mortality. I think that's why a lot of people back burner it. And also selfish people have zero place for life insurance. They're like, what's in it for me? I'm gonna pay for this thing and I'll never get to enjoy it. Why do I want this? So,
yeah.
But people that love somebody or care about something or even have a deep interest in their business, they get it right away, and they should hopefully realize that they're not gonna be here forever.
Great. So I think we covered tons of stuff. I appreciate it. Very detailed, great examples. Key employee insurance, I think, is something that I wasn't aware of. I personally never had key employee insurance. I never had life insurance. Never even want to talk about life insurance. I mean, this conversation that I didn't want to have. But I feel like this is it's a missing link. Maybe even the life insurance is misstated.
Sure.
It's more about the succession planning. I think it's an incredible tool. You do an amazing job, and I enjoy working with you, and I appreciate you joining me on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Is there anything that we missed that you feel would be beneficial for, I mean, our listeners are the business owners.
Right. I have one thing, and I talk to people about this a lot, and it's using life insurance as an asset class.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people take their nest eggs and their 401ks and their savings and everything else, and they invest them in 401ks, IRAs, and the sort, all different investment vehicles. And they usually go into the markets. And I always tell people, you're a business owner. When are you most likely going to need your nest egg? Is it going to be during good economic times or bad economic times? It's usually going to be during bad economic times. When are you going to have to dip into those reserves? Bad economic times. What's the first thing that goes wrong in any bad economy?
Well,
stock market crash,
bank ties up.
Well, usually the stock market is the precipitous for all downturns in the economy, right? Go back to the stock market crash 1929, 88, 99, 2003, 2008.
Do you think we're in the recession already?
No, I'm not gonna go down that rabbit hole. my point is this. What people don't realize is, where's your safe money? Are you putting in a savings account earning 1% and getting taxed on that annually? You need another bucket of money that's available to you, fully liquid, with no penalties of early withdrawal, that's not with any direct recognition to the markets. I find as a small business owner, you're most likely going to need your money in a down market. You're most likely going to need your money when the bank won't loan you any. You hear that every single day. The cash value in a life insurance policy, I use it as an asset class. Is it better than the markets? Absolutely not. Is it uniquely timed to benefit you during those economic events to where the markets are in correction or in below in the red? I think it's an excellent tool to use as a buffer asset to buy you time until the markets can recover. So I always say to people, what if you needed your money in a down market? And I'd say, when are you most likely going to need your money? Probably a down market. What's the first thing that went wrong? The market went down. So now you have the choice of locking in your losses, taking the loss, and then paying sometimes the early withdrawal penalty to access that cash that was supposed to be your nest egg. I kind of, in my mind, it's like putting your most important people, your generals, your the people that are the most important in a war, putting them on the front lines in the infantry with a gun in their hand.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're excellent soldiers, but sometimes those resources are better kept behind and safer areas, and maybe communication channels opened up between there and the front lines. I find that a lot of people put their nest egg on the front lines, in the markets, fully invested, right up until the day they retire, and even after that, and they hope and pray that the markets are doing well.
Yeah.
The markets don't care when you retire, and they don't care what you need, right? So you need a buffer asset, and some people nowadays are using this as the bond equivalent in their portfolio. So this is where they're putting their safe money. This is where they're utilizing it, and it's not going to be better than the markets, and it's not something that is for all of your money, but it's nice to have another class of assets that's available to you, that's fully liquid, that's going to grow at a predetermined rate of return, and it's going to be available to you when that crisis arises.
Yeah, just
and
in
to,
case.
And to weather the storm and to buffer that asset. And then the last thing that's kind of new in the forefront, since maybe some of the people that are listening to this haven't bought life insurance in the last decade, a lot of people say, well, what do I care? I'll be dead. When it comes to life insurance, what do I care? I'll be dead. They'll figure it out. The reality is life insurance has changed, and the life insurance products that are offered today are not the ones that were offered to your parents. They're giving people access to the cash value through different tools, and they're also giving people access to the death benefit while they're alive to fund a long-term care event. That's stuff that didn't exist with your parents' policies. It's just kind of reached the forefront in the last 8 to 9 years. And what they're doing is they're giving people access to the death benefit while they're alive to fund, to pay for a long-term care event. Do they have to use it for that? No. Can they use it for that? Yes. They have to add a rider onto their contract to allow them access to it. But if they can't do 2 of the 6 activities of daily living, which are toileting, transferring, bathing, clothing, eating, incontinence, or if they have any mental diminishment, Alzheimer's, amnesia, dementia, anything like that, they just need one, then they can access the death benefit. It can also help a partnership or a business that has a person that's afflicted with a terrible disease. It'll give them access to that death benefit while they're alive to help them weather that storm and to help them keep the business afloat during a very difficult time. So that's the only other thing that I think maybe I didn't go deep enough onto, so I just wanted to cover that, Dennis.
I appreciate it, Mark. You delivered a lot of value, and I appreciate you coming over.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.